This is Akashvani. In our special program, now we bring you an exclusive interview with Honorable Chief Justice of India, Dr. Justice D.Y. Chandrachur, on the occasion of 75th anniversary of the establishment of the Supreme Court of India. Interviewer is Pragya Devra, Akashvani correspondent.
The Supreme Court of India is in its 75th year of establishment. In this context, it is important that we discuss about the challenges and initiatives regarding the judiciary. To discuss about the various aspects relating to the judiciary, we have with us the Honorable Chief Justice of India, Dr. Justice D.Y. Chandrachur with us. Welcome to Akashvani, sir.
Thank you very much and namaskar to all.
To begin with, I would like to know your memories of All India Radio. During your growing up years, you've heard All India Radio, which must have left lasting impressions. So if you could share with us some of your memories, your association with Akashvani and the role it has played in your life.
Well, I came to the studios of Akashvani first as a 19-year-old who was in college. But my association with All India Radio goes much earlier than that. For one thing, I was always listening to the news, which was a family tradition. So I still remember listening to the English news in those days. The newsreader at 9 o'clock for the news used to be Pamela Singh, Lotika Ratnam, Borun Haldar. These were the icons of that era. I still remember listening to the news in Hindi, which used to precede the English news. And the famous voice was that of Devkinandan Pandey. In fact, he would say, you know, in a very deeply resonating voice, he would say, "Ye Akashvani hai. Ab aap samachar suniye Devkinandan Pandey se." And then you had this very delicate voice of Pamela Singh and Lotika Ratnam, very immaculate voice when they would say, "This is All India Radio, the news read by Lotika Ratnam." And then I would listen to the Sanskrit news every morning with my parents. They say, "Yam Akashvani Samprati Varta Shriyantam." So those words are in that sense so vivid in my memory. But going to my own personal association with All India Radio, my mother was a classical musician who had trained under Gana Saraswati Kishori Amonkarji. So I have visited these studios in Mumbai with my mother as a young third standard, fourth standard child for her recordings. When I came to Delhi in 1972 and joined college later on in 1975, I was told that, you know, I could audition for Akashvani. And I started doing programs both in Hindi as well as in English. I used to do a lot of programs in Hindi. I remember my first program so vividly even now. It was on what is called the Anavarat Yojana, that is the rolling plans under the five-year plans then in implementation. And I did a lot of programs in Hindi. I did Western music for All India Radio in those days. So I used to be the disc jockey for several Western music programs. But above all, I'd like to mention two individuals who really mentored me as a young person. One was Kamala Shastri, who used to supervise us for the Hindi programs. And the other was, of course, Usha Puri, who is our mentor and who is to do a lot of work with us in the English music programs. But what they did was really they helped us mentor into people who could speak on the radio. Most of it was live radio in those days. And they taught us voice modulation, the ability to be precise, to do your research in advance. So the learning lessons which I received from All India Radio were not just confined to the studio, but they were learning lessons of life which I learned from them. And to this day, I look upon my association with All India Radio with so much of gratitude because it helped me shape my own career, my own personality, and to perhaps lay the groundwork for a public life in service of the nation.
That's really interesting, sir. You eventually went on to become the judge of the Bombay High Court, the Chief Justice of the Allahabad High Court, and then you were the judge of the Supreme Court and now the Chief Justice of India. The e-courts project has been implemented throughout the country, which aims at transforming the judicial system through information and communication technology. So what has been your experience? How have you seen the judicial system transform over these years? And what more needs to be done?
The judicial system really which we inherited from the British was a system based on colonial laws and colonial procedures. And ever since the year 2007, I think the judiciary made a very conscious effort to incorporate technology in its functioning. And the impact of the e-courts project has been so significant, particularly during and after COVID. COVID would have meant that we would have had to shut down our courts if it were not for the benefit of technology. But we had a robust infrastructure in place, which we used effectively in COVID for virtual hearings. We used the existing infrastructure consisting of our desktops, video conferencing platforms, the inbuilt cameras, and what initially emerged as an immediate response to COVID has now taken shape very firmly in the judicial system. We have adopted technology, I must emphasize, as a citizen-centric service. The idea of technology is not to create a new monster which will exist apart from our citizens, but to make life easier for our citizens when they access our courts. We have e-filing, our files have been digitized, we have e-payments, we have virtual courts. We have virtual courts, particularly in the traffic challan cases. For instance, in my court in the Supreme Court of India, I run a completely paperless court. So all files are digitized when they come to me. I dictate my judgments into a software. I make my editing changes entirely on my laptop. But at the end of it all these initiatives which we have adopted must be tested from the perspective of whether we have benefited citizens for whom our service is intended to serve. Because all the technology which we adopt in the nation would mean little to citizens if they do not benefit from it. So throughout, our effort has been to ensure that technology takes our work to the homes and hearts of people. We have adopted live streaming of important cases of the Constitution benches in the Supreme Court. Live streaming is extremely important because we are able to reach to all the homes of people. They can understand the nature of the proceedings which goes on in the court. They understand the seriousness with which even small problems of citizens are dealt with by the highest court of the nation. Apart from this, another very important project which we have adopted as part of our technology mission is to translate all the judgments of the Supreme Court into the languages which are recognized by the 8th schedule to the Constitution. As you know, the judgments of the Supreme Court are delivered in English. The proceedings take place in English because it's a court which represents the entirety of the nation. Now, we have about 37,000 judgments of the Supreme Court which have been delivered in English since the birth of the Supreme Court, and it's 75 years old now. All the 37,000 judgments have been translated into Hindi. We have today translated about 76,000 judgments in terms of different languages. 22,000 judgments have been translated into Punjabi, and the translation is taking place in all regional languages. The idea of doing this translation, which is through artificial intelligence or machine-assisted learning, is to ensure that the work which we do as an institution can be comprehended and understood by the people for whom that work is intended. Moreover, our district courts conduct proceedings in regional languages. Evidence is given in regional languages. So the idea of doing all this is to ensure that our services, in terms of the judgments which we deliver, the output of our processes, is known to people simply in languages which they understand. One last point which I would like to mention is that we have put together what we call the e-Supreme Court reports, which is a digitalized version of the paper reports which until now were very popular. Now, the digital reports have provided a free resource. So any citizen, maybe a student in a law college, a litigant, someone who has some need to access information about their legal rights, can go to the e-SCR or the digital SCR and source all our judgments online free of charge. We have set up e-Seva Kendras. Now, the e-Seva Kendras, which we have set up under the e-Courts project, basically ensure that the internet divide does not deprive anyone of information. So every one of the court establishments in India, we have about 3,000 odd court establishments in India covering about nearly 18,000 courts, and every court has an e-Seva Kendra, so that all the services which are provided as part of the e-Courts Mission Mode project are available to citizens even in a physical space. So even if a citizen does not have access to the internet, does not have a smartphone, that doesn't matter. Our services will be provided free of charge at all these e-Seva Kendras across the nation.
With regard to information and communication technology, the Supreme Court has been giving training to its visually impaired personnel regarding use of digital technology. Could you share with us what are the steps that the Supreme Court is undertaking to ensure that the judicial system is accessible for persons with disabilities, both as people working in the court as well as those seeking justice?
Under the eCourts project, we have human resources on a knowledge platform as well. Now, what we have done is that we have people with disabilities and who are working across India. The first important thing was to train these people, the members of our own staff who work in our establishments. So we've been conducting training programs across India as part of our annual calendar to first and foremost equip our staff and to ensure that they do not remain in the back offices, but they are dignified members of the workforce. The second thing that we have been able to do is that we conducted in the Supreme Court an accessibility audit of the premises of the Supreme Court. And this involved very broad-based stakeholder consultation of people who are domain experts on disability and various forms of disability, who came, examined and assessed the premises of the Supreme Court and told us what more we have to do. So a simple example which I can give you is that we have set up a one-point contact desk. So any litigant who enters the Supreme Court goes to that one-point desk where every kind of service or question which needs to be answered would be made available in terms of information to them. We have set up tactile paths for persons with visual disabilities to access the Supreme Court better. For a very long period of time, simple things like our websites had visual captures. So we have changed that by providing for audio captures. So simple initiatives like this can go a long way in making the workplace more inclusive for people. We had in my court a young woman lawyer who has both hearing and speech impairment. She is qualified in the law and she would like to have an access to the opportunity to present her cases before the court. So for the first time, we introduced sign language interpreters for people like her. So these are various initiatives which we have adopted in the course of our proceedings in the Supreme Court. Interestingly, I must share this as well with you, that we have set up what we call the Mitti Cafe in the precincts of the Supreme Court. Now, the Mitti Cafe is run exclusively by people with disabilities. And the importance of that initiative, which has been extremely successful, is to allow civil society to understand that people with different forms of physical disability can yet contribute as equal members of the workplace. And the cafe which we have set up in the Supreme Court premises, and which thereafter was followed by a similar cafe at the Rashtrapati Bhavan. I know as a matter of fact that the cafe in the Supreme Court has been extremely popular with lawyers, with litigants. But above all, it sends a message of inclusion, you know, consistent with the principles of reasonable accommodation under the Rights of Persons with Disabilities Act 2016.
Taking that forward, what is the present status with regard to representation of women in the judiciary? And when I'm asking this, it's not just about numbers, but the kind of opportunities, the kind of work that one gets. Also, what steps are being undertaken to ensure that they get equal opportunity to work?
I think we need to begin with legal education itself, because it's through a more inclusive educational space that we can inculcate the participation of more women in the judiciary or in other branches of the legal profession. With the setting up of the 5-year law course in the 1990s in various universities, including the national law universities, we have seen that women are increasingly being admitted to these institutions. Another learning experience which we have had is that if women are given an equal opportunity to compete for employment, then the experience is that women succeed like no other segment of our society. So, for instance, in the open recruitment examinations to the district judiciary across India, our statistics indicate that over 50% of the recruits are women. In some states, the recruitment of women at the lowest levels of the judiciary, from where they will rise over a period of time, has extended to 60% or 70%. These are remarkable statistics which are being replicated across India, and not just in one or two states. And this indicates that with the spread and growth of women's education in India, more and more women are now entering into the legal profession. And that trend has to be really bolstered by ensuring that we create adequate opportunities for women throughout their career. So women typically perform multifold responsibilities in most of our homes. Now, what we have to do is to ensure that we retain women even at a time when they have these manifold responsibilities to perform. And video conferencing, for instance, which we have introduced as part of our hearing process in the Supreme Court, in the High Courts, in the district judiciary, has been a very important source for providing mobility and inclusion for women. Because as opposed to spending the whole day in a court, say waiting for a case to reach, a woman who has a small child can as well work from home. she can join in on the link when it's time for the case to reach and be just in the court for that duration of time when you are required to argue your case in court. The status of women in the higher judiciary, however, needs improvement. The status of women in the higher judiciary today reflects in many ways the status of the legal profession, say, 15 or 20 years ago. Because the women who joined, say, 20 years ago, the legal profession would be today the women who are obviously going to take higher positions of responsibility. So the change on the ground which is taking place today in terms of more women entering the legal education space or the district judiciary will actually see its impact, I believe, maybe in the next decade or so. But today we need to make more efforts and to do everything to make the workplace more accessible and more hospitable for them. Just as an example, we have set up a creche in the Supreme Court. Our creche in the Supreme Court can accommodate up to between 70 to 100 children. It's extraordinarily popular, not only among the employees of the Supreme Court, but young women lawyers or young men lawyers who bring their little children to the creche every morning, work in the court the whole day, and then take their children home when they go back in the evening. The Supreme Court has delivered judgments which have contributed to greater inclusion of women in the workspace. I can only mention the judgment which was delivered by the Supreme Court, you know, in the case of the grant of permanent commission to women in the armed forces. Now, as a result of that judgment, you have fighter pilots who are women in the Air Force. You have women who are guarding the borders. You have women who are on the warships today of the Indian Navy. So whether it's the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force, the judgments of the Supreme Court are making a real impact on the ground in providing for greater social mobility for women, and in that sense, really transforming our society for the better for the future.
Sir, from your experience, do you also notice a different perspective that comes in with the participation of women?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have shared the bench with some very, very erudite and scholarly women colleagues when I was a judge of the Bombay High Court and, of course, in the Supreme Court of India. And I feel that the importance of having more women on the bench in the courts, for instance, that's my experience, is because the lived realities of women are very different from the lived realities of men. And bringing more women into the workspace ensures that these lived realities of women, they become part of the decision-making process. Because we are all conscious of the fact, and I mentioned this a short while ago, that the kind of experience which women have right from the time that they were children and they were growing up and they went to college or as early professionals varies from the experience which men have. And when women and men interact in the workplace and share experiences, I do believe it accounts for a more inclusive, a more enriching decision-making process. So it's not just about statistics of having more women in the workplace, but it's also in terms of improving the quality of the processes of our public institutions, which makes for a better institutional design and structure when more women are recruited into the workplace.
Sir, with regard to, say, women in the judicial system or persons with disabilities, first generation lawyers, how do you view the role of mentorship?
Traditionally, the legal profession was not a very open system. Our society was emerging from a very feudal background, which we had prior to independence in particular, patriarchal society. Therefore, when the onset of the participation of women, it was not just enough to provide for more opportunities for women to enter the educational space, but to provide them real mentorship, information, opportunities to prove themselves. And I do believe that that mentorship is crucial for women to succeed and to be accepted as equal members of the working area, of the workspace. And mentorship in that sense is also important from the perspective of creating opportunities for women who suffer from intersectional discrimination. There may be women who are not just there in the workplace as women, but there may be a woman who may be belonging to a marginalized section of society and is also physically disabled. So this is what we call in law as intersectional issues of not just gender, but when gender intersects with marginalization or when gender intersects with something like disability. And we have to therefore have a very holistic approach. And that holistic approach can be accepted only if there is adequate mentorship. But with mentorship, we also need to have greater sensitization of decision makers. And decision makers, participants in the workforce, particularly men, have to be made sensitive about the responsibilities which are cast on them. Recently, the Supreme Court brought out a handbook on gender And that handbook on gender, in very simple terms, explains why certain terms or certain forms of discourse in regard to women is simply not acceptable. Why were certain terms not gender neutral? And why are certain terms extremely pejorative to gender? So we have provided for explanations in very simple terms and alternatives in the gender handbook. So this is all about spreading greater awareness, sensitization, and in that process, providing also mentorship to women.
So what would be your message to the first generation lawyers?
The base of the legal system has expanded tremendously. And with the expansion of the base of the legal system, there are more and more opportunities which have emerged for young lawyers. For instance, we have been designating senior counsel in the Supreme Court. And so many of these people who have been designated as senior counsel in the Supreme Court are first timers. They haven't come into the legal profession with a family background. I must also share with you that between 1950 and 2024, only 13 women had been designated as senior counsel. Senior counsel is really, you know, a slightly more elevated form of status in the legal profession when you are accepted to be a person of excellence. But in February 2024, in one go, we designated 12 women as senior counsel. So an equivalent amount to what we had from 1950 to 2024. Likewise, in August of this year, we designated another batch of women lawyers as senior counsel. So what I want to emphasize is that for first timers, it's important to be committed and dedicated to the legal profession. This is a difficult profession in the sense that there you can't cut corners. And the foundation which you lay in your initial years in the legal profession is what keeps you in good stead throughout your careers. And there are always ups and downs in a profession. Because unlike, you know, say a salary job, you don't take home a salary at the end of the month. Initially, the amount which you make at the end of your first month in the legal profession may not be very high. Therefore, I think it's important while first-timers are encouraged to hang in there and to put in hard work and be sincere in the work which we do. Equally, I think our structures must change as well. For instance, lawyers must learn how to pay proper wages, proper salaries, proper emoluments to young lawyers who enter their chambers. Because there's a perception of lawyers that, well, youngsters come to your chamber to learn. Youngsters do come to chambers to learn, but equally, youngsters today have a great deal to share. So it's a two-way process, really, of absorption and sharing and mentorship, which we have to provide to the younger lawyers.
Talking about access to the judicial system, specifically about the marginalized segments of our society, from your experience, how do they understand and navigate the rules, the procedures, the laws? And how can we make a common person, including people from marginalized segments of our society, more aware about the judicial system, the redressal mechanisms available?
The first step is demystification. Because for too long, the law has really remained as a discipline which is not easy to comprehend for ordinary citizens, and more so for people belonging to marginalized segments of our society. So the first and most important step that needs to be taken, and which is being taken, is to simplify not just laws, but simplify procedures, make them user-friendly. The second, I think, is to create awareness. For instance, we find a large number of under-trials belong to marginalized segments of society. Now, those under-trials may not have an awareness of their legal rights, of the legal aid which is available to them. So that is, again, a very crucial endeavor, which is that the law and judicial services must reach out to these people, as opposed to requiring these people to reach out to the judicial institution. Much of the work which we have done in terms of technology is about spreading awareness. Well, apart from that, there are various other initiatives which can be taken. For instance, one initiative which we have adopted recently in the Supreme Court is to have a special Lok Adalat. Now, the purpose of the special Lok Adalat, which we held in the month of August 2024, was to provide very simple and flexible solutions to the problems faced by common people. It may be somebody who is, you know, facing a check dishonor, somebody whose relative was injured or killed in a motor accident and is waiting for compensation. Now, many of the people who seek these reliefs do belong to the marginalized strata of society, or maybe a student who was applying for admission. Just a couple of weeks ago, I had the example of a Dalit student who was not able to gain admission to college for the simple reason that, you know, he was not able to complete the online procedures on time. I've had cases of a student applying for admission to an IIT, for instance, whose father was a daily wage laborer, but who couldn't pay the fee of 17,500 by the cutoff time. That is where I believe we as judges owe a duty to ensure that we do not allow the technicalities of the law to get a better of justice. In this particular case, I said that, well, we must create a seat for this young student who was admitted to IIT Dhanbad. So there are a lot of these students who have tremendous talent. There's a great amount of talent in the country which cuts across social strata. And I think the legal system in particular has a huge responsibility in terms of creating structures, in creating remedies and providing relief to citizens who are in need. Legal aid in particular has a crucial role to play. And I think legal educational institutions, law colleges, the universities must play a very dynamic role in setting up and fostering legal aid clinics to provide basic services to people who can be made aware of their rights.
Sir, as the Supreme Court would be completing 75 years of its establishment in a few months from now, what is the one thing that the Supreme Court has done extremely well which other countries can learn from India? And what is the one thing where the Supreme Court needs to work upon?
I think the key thing of the Supreme Court over the last 75 years is that it has emerged as a people's court. This perspective of the Supreme Court of India being a people's court has not been replicated by courts in other parts of the world. We stand for protecting the fundamental rights of people, whether in civil cases or criminal cases or constitutional cases. And no case for us is too small, because we understand as judges that behind every case lies a story of injustice and the expectation of our citizens that justice will be done to them. The challenge for the future, I think, is to find an answer to the arrears of cases in our courts and to reduce the time which is taken for conclusion of cases. How do we do that? I think there has to be more investment in the infrastructure of courts. The judge-to-population ratio has to be improved. The processes of the law have to be made more simple so that cases can go to trial much quicker than they can at present. And above all, to make conscious efforts through knowledge management and litigation management strategies to curb the delays in the process of the law.
As the Supreme Court completes 75 years, what is your vision for this pillar of democracy?
Well, my vision for the pillar of democracy is to build on our strengths and to reach out to people. There must be a sense of confidence of all our citizens in the work which we do, because the credibility and legitimacy of the institution of the Supreme Court as an institution lies in the confidence which people have in us. And that confidence we can sustain provided we provide flexible, efficacious, and quick solutions to the disputes which people bring to the Supreme Court. We have to continue to build on our traditional values, which is justice for people, with all that is modern, namely knowledge management, deployment of technology, the use of artificial intelligence. So in that sense, going forward, the Supreme Court must combine what is traditional and use that in conjunction with what is modern to make it relevant to our times.
As we come to the end of this interview, what would be your message to the listeners of Akashvani, especially the youth?
Well, my message to the listeners of Akashvani and particularly the youth is to be involved in public affairs. It's very important that each of us fulfill our duties as citizens, just as we are conscious of our rights as citizens. And I think it's important that particularly the younger generation must take greater interest in the conduct of public affairs, read extensively, share ideas, be tolerant, be accepting of people who have different views from us, to enable us to have intelligible conversations with each other. I think the ability to listen, the ability to share, and the ability to understand the perspectives of others is crucial to the society of the future. And particularly in the age of technology, when everybody has a short listening span of 10 seconds or 20 seconds, it's important that we also tell people that there is some value in the good old values of listening carefully, understanding people, and then, of course, forming your own views about particular issues.
Today, we got to know about various aspects relating to the judiciary, right from access, how information and communication technology has been integrated by the Supreme Court, how it is a people's court, and whether it be persons with disabilities, women, marginalized sections of society, the various steps that are being undertaken, your association with All India Radio, and your message for the listeners of Akashvani. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure and an honor to be here.
You were listening to an exclusive interview with Honorable Chief Justice of India, Dr. Justice D.Y. Chandrachud, on the occasion of 75th anniversary of the establishment of the Supreme Court of India. Interviewer was Pragya Devra, Akashvani correspondent. This program was produced and presented by the News Services Division of Akashvani.